Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Sherelle Barber, National Advisor and Coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign COVID-19 Health Justice Advisory Committee, who discusses the alarming data that finds people dying from the coronavirus are disproportionately from communities of color. Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the City University of New York and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, who examines the coronavirus-triggered steep rise in unemployment that's led to a massive loss of health insurance coverage. And Lori Martin of Haven's Harvest, who explains the difficulty her group and other food banks across the country are encountering in fulfilling their mission to provide basic food supplies to those in need during the coronavirus crisis. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As a confrontation between the Trump administration and South Korea over sharing defense costs heats up, over 4,000 South Korean workers were furloughed on April 1st without pay. These workers support the U.S. military force of nearly 29,000 troops stationed in South Korea, there to project American military power in East Asia. The layoffs came in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic as South Korea emerged as a global leader in containing the virus. This is the first furlough of South Korean workers since the U.S. and South Korea signed a military alliance in 1953. In 2019, South Korea agreed to an 8% increase in annual cost sharing, totaling $920 million, which expired in December. In talks to renew the 2020 agreement, Trump demanded $5 billion in cost sharing, which was rejected by the South Koreans as a shameless shakedown. Ahead of South Korea's mid-April parliamentary elections, Trump has already rejected Seoul's likely best offer of a 13% increase. But longtime observers of U.S.-South Korean relations say the greater risk now is permanent damage to the alliance and undermining military readiness for any future conflict with North Korea. The deadly COVID-19 pandemic across the United States forced the closure of many non-essential services such as bars, restaurants, and theaters, which rapidly produced double-digit unemployment. The federal government stepped in with a $2.2 trillion stimulus package that included expanded unemployment benefits and loans to small businesses. The Federal Reserve intervened with unprecedented measures to boost liquidity and provide urgent aid to an economy in freefall. However, the American Prospect forecasts that a critical debate in the months ahead will focus on calls for austerity in state capitals, many of which are required to maintain balanced budgets. In recent economic downturns, Republican-controlled legislatures imposed deep cuts on education, colleges and universities, infrastructure, and healthcare. Fiscal troubles lie ahead as the Federal CARES Act stimulus bill approved only $150 billion in funds that will fill just 15% of state and local governments' projected fiscal gaps. In past recessions in 2001 and 2008, many states slashed vital services such as food stamps, childcare, and aid to senior citizens. After the Great Recession, teachers saw their wages stagnate for a decade, particularly in red states. Only recently has a wave of teacher strikes in places like West Virginia and Oklahoma put teacher salaries and benefits back on the legislative agenda. New York State, controlled by Democrats, financed its $10 billion deficit by cutting funding for Medicaid, services to the elderly and poor, and aid to local school districts. Still, progressive state legislators have proposed alternatives to imposing painful austerity measures, including raising taxes on the wealthy, taxing the legal consumption of marijuana, and calling for increased federal support. Florida voting rights advocates praised a ruling by federal district judge Robert Hinkle to expand a lawsuit challenging the state's limits on the voting rights of former felons. The case will decide whether or not 430,000 Florida ex-felons who can't afford to pay outstanding fines and fees will be able to register to vote. In 2018, Florida voters overwhelmingly approved Amendment 4, restoring voting rights for felons who completed their prison sentences. But Republican Governor Ron DeSantis and the GOP-controlled state legislature responded by passing a law requiring all felons to pay previously imposed fines, fees, and restitution before they could vote. This blocked 430,000 of the eligible 1.4 million ex-felons from casting ballots. Critics blasted the move as a Jim Crow-era poll tax and blatant voter suppression. Last October, Judge Hinkle ruled that 17 ex-felon plaintiffs can register to vote despite unpaid fines, a ruling that was upheld in February by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Hinkle also ruled that his decision at the end of the trial that begins April 27th will apply to all felons in Florida, not just the 17 who sued the state last year. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The coronavirus pandemic has impacted virtually every nation on Earth, from the wealthiest high-tech cosmopolitan centers of commerce to impoverished developing nations dependent on agriculture. Here in the U.S., all 50 states are battling to contain the COVID-19 virus and marshaling resources in varying degrees to provide urgent medical care to those stricken with the disease. But an examination of the data compiled thus far on Americans who have died after contracting the coronavirus, finds that counties with a majority black population have 3 times the rate of infections and almost 6 times the rate of deaths as counties where white residents are in the majority. For example, less than 30% of people in Chicago, Illinois are black, yet 70% of the lives lost to COVID-19 are African American. In the state of Louisiana, with a black population of 32%, black people also make up 70% of COVID-19-related deaths. New York City officials reported that black and Latino residents were dying at twice the rate of white people. Black residents in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, have seen similarly disproportionate mortality rates. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Sherelle Barber, National Advisor and Coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign's COVID-19 Health Justice Advisory Committee. Dr. Barber, a faculty member at Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health, Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, comments on growing concerns surrounding the alarming racial disparities in coronavirus-related deaths and the action her group is advocating.
As a social epidemiologist, part of my job description is to count deaths. And I've looked at, through my research in chronic diseases, and particularly in the South and Brazil, have looked at the ways in which structural racism really shapes health and health inequalities. And what we know for blacks and other marginalized racial groups in this country is that because of the legacy and the history of slavery, of oppression, the laws that have been in place for decades that kind of disinvest certain communities, blacks have the highest mortality rates for most major causes of disease. And so colleagues and I, just about 3 or 4 weeks ago, really knew that even before the data emerged, we were going to see these really striking inequalities for a number of reasons, right? So you can look at some of the inadequacies in the healthcare system, the ways in which communities of color in particular have very limited access to affordable healthcare before this crisis. Then in a crisis like this, when you're mostly able to access testing and treatment through hospitals and other healthcare settings, black communities are disproportionately impacted. In addition to that, we know that within the healthcare system, there are striking experiences of discrimination, of bias, both unconscious and conscious bias. Have heard anecdotal stories of people, reporting to, hospitals with symptoms of COVID-19 just to be turned away and then, subsequently passing away. And so we know that those exist, and we know that there are deep flaws in the ways we've structured our society. So many cities that we see in, for example, Milwaukee, Chicago, New Orleans, a number of cities where we're seeing these disproportionate rates of mortality among Blacks are also cities that are highly segregated. And we know that from a legacy, again, of systemic racism, of, you know, policies that date back to the 1930s, like redlining, but also the subsequent disinvestment that has happened in those communities, again, that keep, you know, these communities from being healthy, limited access to health care, but also other amenities that would be important in this during this pandemic.
Dr. Barber, how could we address the short-term disproportionate impact of this coronavirus crisis?
Right.
What can be done right at this moment when so many people's lives are on the line?
Right, yeah. So one of the things that the Poor People's Campaign is really looking into is, you know, in what ways, for example, in places like the South, where you have not had an expansion of Medicaid in many of the states that are going to be hard hit by this coronavirus, can Congress pass a law? And can these states really kind of move towards Medicaid expansion? We know that many of the workers who are being laid off, their employment status, you know, is what dictates their insurance. And so, you know, in this moment, we need to be expanding health care to those who've either lost insurance because they've become employed or still just are underinsured or uninsured in this moment. So this is something I think states can do in this moment, even though it seems like a more long term, you know, but I do think it's something we have to expand access to health care at the very minimum in order to make sure that folks get the proper testing they need and then also the proper treatment. Because, again, even if we were to expand testing without expanding treatment and payment for treatment, you know, many people will go without getting treated because the cost of it is so high, right? And so that will, again, lead to folks foregoing medical care simply because they can't afford it. So in this moment when we've bailed out corporations, why don't we bail out the masses of individuals who don't have access to health care and who don't have, you know, the ability to pay for expensive hospital bills?
President Trump has said that he wants to open the U.S. back for business as soon as possible, and that may happen without a proper vaccine or an effective treatment to minimize the death rate from the COVID-19 virus. If the U.S. opens back up too early, it's certain people of color will pay a disproportionate price for that bad decision. What are your concerns surrounding this push by the Trump regime to move quickly to restore normalcy across the U.S.?
It's really reckless and it's unacceptable coming from, you know, the highest office in the land. And I've really, myself and my public health colleagues have just been so appalled at the reckless nature in which this president has really not listened to science, not listened to the data, not engaged in the, you know, necessary actions to mitigate the disease from the onset. So we could have had testing early on. We could have prepared for this because we knew about other countries who were experiencing things. You know, the virus, would it have come? Yes. But we could have definitely mitigated the number of deaths and the number of cases that we're seeing. And now the U.S. is the epicenter. And that's because of inaction and reckless actions of this administration. And so for him to even say or suggest that by a certain date, you know, we'll be able to reopen the economy, again, that focus on the economy and not the people is just so misguided. But, you know, where's the science? Where's the data to even say that? We're not even doing the proper surveillance. You know, we're doing testing, but we're not doing full-scale surveillance where we actually know where cases are, who has, you know, the virus. And yes, you're exactly right. It's going to have a disproportionate impact on Black communities, on Latino communities, on poor communities, on Native American communities, because we were already seeing the impact. And it's just going to be devastating if we try to reopen too soon.
That was Dr. Sherelle Barber, National Advisor and Coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign's COVID-19 Health Justice Advisory Committee. Find more analysis and commentary on the alarming racial disparities among those afflicted by the coronavirus by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A new study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine titled Intersecting U.S. Epidemics, COVID-19 and Lack of Health Insurance found that with millions of Americans losing their jobs during the coronavirus lockdown, an estimated 13.5 million people will lose their employer-based health insurance coverage by the end of June. These figures do not include coverage losses among self-employed persons or other job losers who did not file unemployment claims or their dependents. The research was conducted by Dr. Steffi Woolhandler and David Himmelstein, both internal medicine specialists who serve as distinguished professors at the City University of New York's Hunter College and are lecturers at Harvard Medical School. An earlier study conducted by Drs. Woolhandler and Himmelstein in 2017 concluded that 18,000 persons die each year in the U.S. due to lack of health insurance. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Woolhandler, a co-founder and board member of the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who discusses the inherent problem of linking health insurance coverage with employment exposed by the pandemic, and how the current health crisis has created momentum to move the U.S. to a universal single-payer healthcare system.
We were able to estimate that about 5 million people have lost insurance due to the 16.6 million people who've lost their jobs. And if the Federal Reserve Bank's estimates that more than 40 million Americans will lose their job by the end of this fiscal quarter, that is by June 30th of this year, if that estimate is correct, 13.5 million Americans will lose their health insurance. That on top of the 30 million Americans who had no health insurance prior to the COVID crisis will bring us to 43 million Americans with no health insurance who are many of them unemployed, but not all of them, but 43 million uninsured who will be facing a potentially life-threatening illness with no health coverage to help them pay for the cost. So this is a double disaster, if you will. People are at risk of a life-threatening illness, and yet they've lost their health insurance and have no way to pay for this care. So, and this, of course, is something that we can lay squarely at the feet of politicians, including Donald Trump. We really need to get 100% coverage of the population through a Medicare for All plan. So that won't, you know, Medicare for All won't prevent COVID any more than it can prevent an earthquake or a zombie apocalypse or whatever, but it would make us have more of the tools we need to get everybody treated and identify cases early and control this epidemic.
Dr. Woolhandler, what could be done now in terms of a federal response to this huge number of people who've lost their jobs and hence have lost their private health insurance? What can be done to fill the gap, especially during this urgent crisis where so many people will be faced with their own personal crisis of having to be forced to seek medical care, maybe in some cases to save their lives?
Right, to save their lives. The federal government tomorrow could do a lot. The states and local governments are, in fact, quite limited. Because with the exception of Vermont, the other 49 states, by law, have to balance their budget. They cannot run a deficit. So when their tax revenues start to fall, as they do in a recession like this, they don't have the tax money to go and do spending. Federal government does not have that restriction. The federal government can do deficit spending. It can borrow money. Frankly, it can print money if it wants to. So there's no restriction on federal spending in a crisis.
Are there any signs that Congress and this president, Donald Trump, would be willing to fill the gap here in this moment of crisis to pay for people's health insurance during this pandemic?
Senator Sanders in the Senate and Congresswoman Jayapal in the House have introduced a bill saying that everybody's uninsured and or unemployed, but anyone who's uninsured for any reason needs to be placed on a Medicare for All program between now and the end of the epidemic. That has been introduced in the House and Senate. You might have said 3 weeks ago that was pie in the sky, but a lot of things are possible in a crisis like this that might not have been possible earlier. Certainly, Congress has already declared that testing is free, and that's a good thing that testing is free. But, of course, if you're sick, you don't just need testing. You need testing and treatment. That all needs to be free for people. Congress has already increased sick pay for many people. Unfortunately, employers with 500 or more employees are completely exempted from those rules. So, for instance, most hospitals, most large retail outlets are going to be exempted from the rules. So, but even so, we're seeing a lot of things happen that didn't seem possible before COVID. So this is a very critical time for people who support social justice, people who care about these issues, to be out there working and speaking and advocating, even if you're doing it over the telephone or over Zoom. You need to be advocating and speaking out about the needs of the American people.
That was Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, Distinguished Professor of Public Health and Health Policy at the City University of New York's Hunter College and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Find links to Dr. Wohlhandler's recent study on the loss of employer-based health insurance and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The coronavirus pandemic has led to the most precipitous economic freefall in U.S. history, with 16 million Americans filing for unemployment in the past 3 weeks. In less than 1 month, the coronavirus pandemic has displaced more than 10% of American workers, outpacing the worst month of the Great Recession. Meanwhile, many of the workers now considered essential are paid low wages without health insurance, just one illness away from disaster. These conditions have led to the steepest rise in hunger in the U.S. since the Great Depression. Many poor families can't afford to buy food, and food banks are running out of basics as miles-long lines of cars wait to pick up anything they can get. Mutual aid groups have popped up in some cities to try to staunch the misery. Over the past year, the nonprofit New Haven, Connecticut-based group, Haven's Harvest, has solicited and received food donations from restaurants, food markets, colleges, and private events, and delivered them to needy daycare centers, senior centers, and low-income neighborhoods. But since the coronavirus pandemic and economic lockdown, the situation for food banks and their recipients has changed drastically. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lori Martin, founder and executive director of Haven's Harvest. Here she explains that although things have changed, her organization is still doing their best to distribute food to hungry people.
Well, what has changed is that a lot of our receiving sites are now closed, like the daycare centers and the schools, our senior day centers, and some of the subsidized senior housing developments have decided not to accept food to reduce the risk for residents. So not only is our food coming in from different places, but then our receiving sites have also changed. So it doesn't look anything like it did 2 weeks ago. But in the meantime, we've gotten huge donations by the literal tons of food from local universities as they closed down and consolidated their kitchens. You know, I'd been working on the grassroots level to find other ways to get food into the community, and I had been working on this for a while, but it really has moved forward with other organizations to get food, like to folks who might be undocumented, artists, for instance, folks who are in the gig economy or have already lost their jobs because, you know, their jobs ended. There are some other grassroots groups like Black Lives Matter and CT Core and Connecticut Bail Fund and some other teachers who know their students, and we've coordinated with some teachers in schools outside of the schools to get food to families. It's been amazing. What I try to explain to folks is, like, I want food to go into all the neighborhoods to be sure that people are covered, but we can't do that alone. You know, we're definitely working with people to figure that out.
How do you see things going forward?
I think it'll shift. I mean, last Saturday in 3 hours, Trader Joe's called with an extra 5 pallets of food is what they initially said. But in fact, we distributed about 8,000 pounds of food into 14 vehicles in 3 hours. That's a huge amount.
How has the pandemic changed your volunteer base with the shelter-in-place order?
I've had some conversations with some volunteers in the last few days about going on sabbatical. Some volunteers have stepped back. Some I actually asked to be on sabbatical because they're getting closer to 80, and although they're also in good health, I'd like them not to be at risk. And but then other folks in the meantime have stepped up because they're not working, and so they're able to step up.
I spoke again to Lori Martin on April 13th, 2 weeks after my initial conversation. Lori, what has changed over the past 2 weeks?
They have changed some because more sites that we work with have closed. Senior residential sites are largely closed. I think we're still working with one site, and that resident service coordinator is accepting the food and then rebagging it and delivering it to individual apartments, which is lovely. But otherwise, we still are creating new relationships with other organizations in order to get the food that we're collecting out to folks in the community. So I'm working with a collective to help get food into the undocumented community here in the city.
We're hearing that food banks around the country are running out of food, and families are lining up in their cars for blocks or miles trying to get some. Have you noticed a drop-off in the food that you collect? And where are you still picking up the food?
There is some drop-off, but there still is excess food. So we still, our usual suppliers are some small grocery stores here in the area. They're still giving us food. A large national chain is still giving us food 2 times daily. So it's nothing like what it looked like before March 12th. Just to say, in terms of the regularity of the size of donations, although those things are still in place, the universities that are local that had been giving us food, they're not giving us as much food, but a couple of them are still in operation to feed students who are still on campus. And so we do get food from them. And yesterday, one donation was about 450 bagged lunches and some other trays of prepared food. So we still do get food, and then we try to figure out where that food can go. I think our connections with the grassroots groups have deepened, and there's a sense of we can do this together, and that the system needs to change in general, the food system in particular, but you know, the other parts of all the systems in the country. And in this way, I think our move forward will be more in solidarity so that we can shift what the food system, at least in this area, looks like. And that I look forward to. It's a good move for the future.
That was Lori Martin, founder and executive director of Haven's Harvest, based in New Haven, Connecticut. Learn more about the plight of food banks struggling to provide food to hungry communities during this coronavirus pandemic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.